waiting for a very exciting presentation. And I would call the first presenter.
Are we going to start with?
No, we're going to go.
Oh, okay.
Chris Goldfinger, Dr. Goldfinger. He is going to talk about open ocean seafloor mapping project. And his partner, Dr. Dawn Wright, works with him. We've heard her give a presentation during the interim committee on emergency preparedness, and I wanted your project to get aired again because we have so many new people. But today we have two new people, and this is going to be very valuable information for you because I have drafted a bill that addresses this issue. So if you would proceed, welcome, and give us your name, and then you can go for it.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and Committee. My name is Chris Goldfinger. I'm Associate Professor of Oceanography at Oregon State. And as Chairman Boone noted, this is a topic that's come up several times before at the subcommittee level and also been presented to OPAC and the state land board recently. And so what I'd like to do is about a year ago at this time, I was here with the full committee and discussed tsunami hazards and earthquakes in scientific terms. And so I want to just quickly as I can run through that. There's actually some updates to that, and then discuss how it relates to seafloor mapping and how they're connected. So the logo soup down at the bottom is a sort of surprisingly large number of organizations that are actually interested in mapping the seafloor for basically two reasons. Tsunami inundation is one, and the other is natural resource management. Most of those up there are involved in the tsunami aspect, but obviously NOAA, NIMS, and Oregon Fish and Wildlife are quite interested in this from the natural resources point of view as well. So I'll talk a little bit about the tsunami aspect of it. Just as an update from a year ago, OSU, Dogami, OHSU, and Pacific Geoscience Center in Canada in the last year started and are just now completing a tsunami inundation pilot project at Cannon Beach. And this project was designed to be a next generation step from the last one that was done mostly by NOAA and USGS at Seaside. And what we tried to do is bring together a complete end-to-end model that would include the tsunami source, that is the earthquake, the hydrodynamic codes that get the wave to the shore, and the run-up on the shore in order to develop a methodology to draw that line on the map that's going to become the state inundation line. And as you probably know, the Senate Bill 379 line was done back in 1995. It was pretty much done by hand by George Priest without benefit of modeling or any modern techniques. And so we're quite far behind at this point in being able to pinpoint where tsunamis are going to inundate the land. So this pilot project was designed to design a methodology to help with that. So just a quick review. Bad actor, the Cascades Subduction Zone. And this is northern Oregon, and you're looking at the accretionary wedge on the left. Let's see if my mouse works. And so this is the North American plate. This is the Juan de Fuca plate. It's about 20 kilometers under the coast and about 50 kilometers under us right where we sit here. And the area that that actually ruptures could be as far out as this or it could be as close as this. Makes quite a big difference in the wave that comes ashore. And that's the part of the Dogami OSU project is to help define where that comes from. As we all know, there's plenty of evidence on shore of past tsunamis. This is from the AD 1700 tsunami that's well known, and well known in Japan from the tsunami that arrived there about 9 hours later. Superimposed on that now is the rupture area of the Sumatra 2004 tsunami, so you can see just a general comparison. They're roughly equivalent in size, and just to reiterate the point that the 1700 tsunami and its all its predecessors in Cascadia and the Sumatra tsunami are more or less equivalent in magnitude, and we expect the tsunamis to be more or less equivalent in size. And we've also seen, of course, all the dead trees in places like Siletz Bay and along Copalis River in Washington. And these are actual evidence of the last tsunami in 1700. So up between the early 90s when this was discovered and now, a number of models have been generated to or created to try to estimate the size of the wave coming ashore and where it will go. This was an early version in about 2000 done by Dogami. This is a more recent version done by USGS by Eric Geist in 2005. Both of these suffered fairly severely from not really knowing what the source area of the earthquake is. And so this one from Eric Geist is essentially random. The locked zone, which is this red part, is allowed to wander sort of randomly within some boundaries. And the maximum wave heights were recorded from that. The Dogami one was also similarly somewhat speculative. So I'll come back to that in a little bit. Here's the wave height along the coast from the USGS scenario, and it actually predicts some extreme waves in places that, like Cape Blanco area, Coos Bay area, that are probably not right just because of the random nature of the original models.
I'm sure.
Yes. Are you all deriving the same conclusions from your own independently gathered data, or are you just all modeling based on the same data set points?
Oh, that's a great question. No, the models are very, very different, actually. The starting assumptions are what are mostly different. The modeling techniques are also different. So there actually today is not a set a set sequence of just exactly how this should be done. It's really the cutting edge science. So people have different ideas of how it should be done. Gesundheit.
Sorry.
And so it's an evolutionary process. So the early models in the 90s and up to 2000 had evolved into the USGS version, and that now is evolving into the Dogami 2007 version. And there'll be further evolution of that.
Thank you.
So the Cannon Beach studies I mentioned, Dogami, OSU, OHSU, and PGC are trying to do that. That next stage evolution, and it's really this is not a minor tweak of previous models. This is really a new start with a clean sheet of paper, and so it's we're really trying to make this the model for the methodology of how you map tsunami inundation, and you really have to consider everything from the very start of the earthquake to the last run up of the wave, and most models today generally don't do that. So one of the ways, here's an example of something that's never actually been done before in the U.S. and really not been done anywhere else in the world, is to try to map the actual extent of the past ruptures with geologic techniques. And there's not time enough to go into this, but the bottom line is the red dashed line now we have through three or four different independent means have pretty good evidence that this is the down dip extent on average of Cascadia ruptures. And it's based on oil well data, it's based on seismic reflection data, past earthquakes, and paleoseismic data. So we can now take this red line and try to model the tsunami run-up from it and see if it actually matches real data from 1700. And that's what the Dogami project is about. And it turns out it matches. Yep.
I'm just not quite sure I understood what you told us. I don't know what the word down dip means.
Oh, I'm sorry. A little jargon. It means the landward extent of the earthquake rupture. So down dip is just the plate is dipping toward the land.
Okay.
And so that line represents the eastern extent of the earthquake rupture. And it's based on several lines of independent evidence.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'll try to keep the jargon to a minimum. It's hard to do sometimes. We also know quite a bit about the past events from paleoseismology, which is just the stratigraphic geologic study of past earthquakes. And again, it's too much detail, but numerous investigators working offshore and onshore have found buried evidence of past earthquakes extending back more than 10,000 years. So we have a very good idea of the rupture lengths of the past earthquakes and to an extent their size. And so this upper panel shows that 17 or 18 events in the last 10,000 years have ruptured the full length of Cascadia from Canada to California. So those would correspond to approximately magnitude 9 earthquakes. The two middle panels are just are several smaller events, and then we have 8 or 9 smaller events that are limited to southern Oregon. So we know quite a bit more than we did when the original models were done about the size, rupture length, and frequency of these great earthquakes. There's my little cheesy tsunami going across there. And so this is the 2007 version of possible rupture scenarios in Cascadia based on new information from Sumatra and based on the geologic data in the Dogami OHSU study. The details here aren't important. The important thing is that instead of just having a random scenario for the tsunamis, we now have real data to go back and forward model the tsunamis as they come ashore. We don't have to rely on just a random guess.
And that's good. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the Sumatra situation, you had a big break for a lot of miles that right. popped up. And I'm trying to understand from this information, is it more common that you have a break for several hundred miles all at one time, or are there pops in the plate that have smaller tsunamis? What's a more common event?
Well, both of those are very common. And what happened in, usually to make a great earthquake, what we call great earthquake, greater than magnitude 8, in the case of Sumatra, it typically takes segments all linked together to go off at once, sort of a zipper effect.
Right.
So you can have one segment go off, and that might be a magnitude 8. If you had two go off, it might be an 8.5. If you have three or more, it might be a 9 or more. And you can have any of those things happen at any time. So what that previous slide was the segment map for Cascadia. We know those smaller segments have gone off numerous times by themselves, but about half the time the full margin goes like on the left panel. So all of those scenarios are possible.
So is it possible, or is it just a natural rotation that there's certain small releases and then there's one big release?
That's a great question. Well, that's the cutting edge of where the science is right now, is trying to determine the sequence of ruptures. We know the sequence. I'm not showing it all here, but we know the sequence, and we're trying to figure out why it ruptures in the sequence that it does. But it typically will go off in a very large one, and then a few sort of gap-filling smaller ones over a long period of time, and then another large one will go off, and that's been the pattern.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So, well, what does this all have to do with seafloor mapping? So, just to give you an idea of what the subduction zone really looks like, this is it. You're looking at the top view is the northern part of Oregon. That's Cape Falcon would be about there. So, this is the deep water part of it, and this is the continental shelf up here. This is looking a little bit farther south. This is Hecate Bank. This is the continental shelf. And the territorial sea is the 3-mile strip right along here. And it looks very flat and featureless, partly because it is flatter than this dramatic mountainscape down here, but it also looks flatter because we don't have very much data there. It's basically an almost no data zone from about the 50-meter contour landward. So why do we care about this? After all, the tsunami is quite large and isn't. It might not seem like it would make too much difference, but here's an example to illustrate how shallow water bathymetry affects a tsunami. And this is a famous big wave surfing area in Hawaii. Just to exaggerate the example, this is called the Jaws on Maui, and this is the bathymetry here in meters. So deep water is over here, and there's an underwater reef right here. And so you can see, this is the generated wave here. You can see how much taller the wave is located over the reef, and how in the canyon area the wave spreads out and is lower in amplitude. So it's really the shallow water bathymetry that controls exactly what happens to the wave as it comes ashore, even if you have big differences in waves that come from different earthquake sources. So the shallow water bathymetry is really critical if you want to do things like model the effect of a tsunami on a town, on a port facility, or anything in any detail close to shore. So most of the previous tsunami efforts have really not considered shallow water bathymetry at all, partly because there isn't any, and partly because the computations to do this are much more involved and take a lot of time and effort. So tsunami models typically just ignore the whole aspect of it and predict the wave height, say, in 20 or 30 meters of water offshore and don't really run the wave all the way into the shore. In effect, the lack of shallow water bathymetry in Oregon essentially puts us in the same position that Indonesia was in, and Indonesia still is, in terms of being able to model the threat to their cities. We can presently do really no better than Padang, Indonesia, in predicting the effect of a tsunami because we don't have shallow water bathymetry. So at this point in time, there's no federal agency, no entity that's mandated or has any plans whatever to map nearshore bathymetry in Oregon or anywhere else in the United States, except Hawaii. The Northern Hawaiian Islands is being mapped for monk seal habitat and other reasons. But there's no tsunami-oriented mapping whatsoever in the U.S. And so for that reason, the states are taking this on, and California and Massachusetts are two of the leaders presently, and they're taking on the effort to map their own waters because they realize the federal agencies are not going to do it. So what do you get when you map the seafloor? Well, on the left is what we have in Oregon. Most of the soundings in Oregon, with the exception of harbor mouths that have been mapped in detail, most of the soundings of the seafloor were done this way between about 1838 and present day. This were done with a lead line, which is a rope hung over the boat and a piece of lead on it, and people measured knots in the rope, and that's how deep the water is. Multi-beam sonar, on the other hand, is a wide swath, high-resolution technique that can give you all of the detail of the seafloor in pretty short order. And so this is what a modern multi-beam map looks like at Nehalem Bank. This is one of the small maps that we have of Oregon margin. And it's used for things like, in addition to tsunami mapping, for seafloor habitat, for fisheries management purposes. And it can be combined with direct seafloor observations from submersibles, from drop cameras, from core samples, from a variety of things, in order to give you a very accurate picture of not only the shape of the seafloor, but what it's actually made of.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, going back to that picture, I mean, those are stunning pictures. tell me whose equipment goes out and serves as the platform to take these pictures.
Well, in the past, I mean, it's generally it can be a variety of people. This particular data set was funded to OSU through NOAA, and it was the pictures on the left were collected by a submarine. By an observer snapping pictures out the submarine window, and the bathymetry data was collected on a NSF operated ship with NOAA funding. So that's collected by a variety of people with a variety of platforms, variety of funding sources.
Chase the money back through OSU. The grant comes from NOAA. Tell me how it moves through the institution.
Well, this particular project, this is actually what you're seeing on the screen, is two different projects. The submarine project was through NOAA, the National Undersea Research Program, and it was funded to OSU to investigate actually active faults off of Oregon. And so the money comes to OSU. We charter a vessel and charter a submarine and go out and do the science with those funds. The picture on the right was actually funded through the NOAA Office of Ocean Exploration, completely different part of NOAA, for a completely different purpose. And their purpose, that grant was funded actually to look at ancient shorelines as they might relate to, oddly enough, archaeological travels of Native Americans.
And I'm making the assumption these are highly competitive grants. What I'm getting to is that OSU is beginning to develop a pocket of expertise that I think has a national, if not an international, reputation at this point. And one of the things that I hope you're able to share with the committee is how sustainable is the funding for this pocket of expertise. We gathered data that's used in all sorts of different applications. You've got a fisheries application. You've got, I don't know the right scientific word, but an anthropological component. You've got a tsunami. You're informed in that arena. I want to get a sense of the magnitude of importance on a national or international basis of this kind of data used in all sorts of different applications.
Well, OSU does have, we have two seafloor mapping labs, my own lab and Don Wright's lab at OSU. We're probably the combined PIs and research assistants and students are probably the best on the West Coast of the U.S., I would say. There's one in University of New Hampshire that's comparable as well.
The real point that I'm getting to, colleagues, is that any ducks in the audience notwithstanding, we have this extraordinary expertise here, and I think sometimes we tend to take it for granted, that here we've got a national, if not international, leader in doing this kind of cutting-edge work, and our obligation to make sure that we celebrate that success, do what we can to continue to advance the work that you and your colleagues are doing. This is remarkable stuff. At what depth are those pictures?
I think the depth's actually on the slide.
Put it this way. At what depth that a normal human being can see are those pictures?
153 meters. So this is the outer continental shelf, about 400 or 500 feet of water or so.
It's amazing.
Well, thanks for your kind words. I appreciate that. I don't feel taken for granted at all. We're here before the committee. But these are things that people don't see every day, and it is, in that sense, taken for granted.
Thank you.
So, thanks for your question. So what happens to these raw data? One of the things that happens to it is it gets turned into a habitat map, which is this. And so just for reference, you can see where the good data exists and where the nautical chart takes over. And so this is typical of, this happens to be Cortez Bank in Southern California, an area that our lab mapped last year. But you can see the contrast between what a nautical chart looks like and what, a well-done seafloor map looks like. So to try to address the absence of seafloor data in Oregon for both the tsunami and the natural resources tasks, we formed a group at OSU and tried to pull in as many natural resource managers, tsunami modelers, state agency heads as we could, because we've been talking about this now since as long as I've been in Oregon, since the late 80s, and we finally realized that nobody was going to do it, so we were in a sense forced to do this. And so we put together an action plan to map the state territorial sea for multi-use, and it's obviously a critical gap in data. It's as far as I can tell, completely apolitical. Everyone wants this data for a variety of purposes. It's an information tool that's really going to be required to do much of anything in the nearshore waters of Oregon, whether it's marine protected areas, a national marine sanctuary, tsunami modeling, what have you. OPAC is charged with, and the state land board is charged with managing those waters, but they do not have the tools to work with or the decision making capability to do it. And the decisions come quite easily when you have information, but without information, it leads to long series of committee meetings that have no resolution. So today, most recently, the governor has put out two proposals for marine protected areas. That's one aspect of it. And then certainly the tsunami aspect is there as well. So what we're talking about is the state territorial sea. That's 3 miles for the in U.S. states. In other places, it's other numbers. The U.S. Exclusive Economic Zone is out here at 200 miles. We're not talking about mapping all of that. Fortunately, most of the EEZ has already been mapped by NOAA and USGS back in the 1980s. That was ordered by President Reagan. But because seafloor mapping gets more and more expensive as you get into shallower and shallower water, they quit when they got to the shelf edge and could not afford to do the continental shelves. And the reason it's more expensive is pretty straightforward. It's really you can only map about 3 or 4 times the water depth in width as you go along in a boat. So when you're in 1,000 meters of water or a mile deep of water, you can map 4 or 5 mile swath wide. But when you're in 50 50 feet of water, you can only map 250 feet wide. So it takes a lot of steaming up and down, mowing the grass to map shallow waters, and that's why everyone avoids doing it.
Well, I have a quick question on that. When we heard Dr. Wright's presentation before, she talked about using LIDAR. Recently, I was in California at a task force meeting and heard Dr. Siri talk about LIDAR by plane.
Mm-hmm.
Can you address that? Because I think that's what California is doing or looking at.
Yes, yes. LIDAR is essentially the same sort of swath mapping technique that's done from boats, only it's done from an airplane. And instead of using sound waves, they use light waves. They use lasers. And so they have a scanning laser that goes back and forth like this as the airplane flies. And it works extremely well on land. It can also work to remove the forest canopy from land. You can actually take the trees out of the LIDAR data and see a bare ground image of what's under the trees. So it's being used by timber companies, by riparian managers, by geologists, and all sorts of people on land. And in some places, you can use it in the water. If the water is clear enough, you can actually, the lasers will penetrate the water, and you can make the right kinds of corrections and actually map the seafloor with lasers. And it works. It's been done in Florida. It's been done in Lake Tahoe. It's been done in Hawaii. And it's going to be used in some areas in California. The problem in the Pacific Northwest is our water is much dirtier, not dirtier, but much more turbid than most of the places that LIDAR has been done. So it's been tried in Washington, and it didn't work very well. The Olympic Coast National Sanctuary tried it off Cape Flattery, and it really didn't work very well at all. So the problem with LIDAR is you could do it in Oregon, but you would have to have a plane on standby waiting for the nice water clarity essentially forever to do it. And to pay somebody to be on standby for weeks and months, and it's just financially impractical. So I don't think it's going to be very viable in Oregon. But it could be used locally, maybe, for estuaries and shallower places. And, I think I'll skip over this. I think we cover this. It's definitely not mapped. This is the, by the way, this is the regional habitat and bathymetric map that we put together at OSU. This is a compilation of bathymetric data that's taken really about 10 years to put together. And most recently, this was interpreted for habitat, which is what the colored blobs are, and incorporated into the essential fish habitat designations by NOAA. And so this is the underlying data for the EFH process that's been done coast-wide. So the territorial sea map that we're proposing would add that the state of Oregon portion of that inshore and be merged with the broader coastwide data set. So about a year ago, this group of people from OSU and from ODFW, Dogami, and a variety of others signed this consensus statement for mapping the territorial sea for all the reasons that I mentioned, and here's just some of the signatories. Vicki McConnell from Dogami is there at the bottom. And so this is quite a broad-based initiative to try to get this done. And here again is just an example. In the case of Oregon, the territorial sea is this gray line out here, 3 miles out. And there are some patches of existing data. This is a one-off survey done by ODFW with a little bit of NOAA money. And so this just gives you an example in Oregon of what a good survey looks like compared to what we have everywhere else. And these are those lead line soundings from the 1800s up through the 1940s or so, as compared to the modern bathymetric survey. So we have about 5% of the territorial sea has data of this quality, and the other 95% pretty much looks like this.
Oh, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any, when there's this mapping being done, are they targeting in front of existing urban areas or small town areas? Is that what's happening? Is that how you guys are coming up with where it gets mapped, or is it have more driven by where the grants are coming from? So if it's fisheries, it's being driven by that rather than
it's being driven by by each agency's priorities. So ODFW has mapped that this image is Siletz Reef. So they're most interested in mapping the rocky reef fishing areas. So they get a little bit of money from NOAA and they go out and map a small postage stamp. And then they do other fisheries related studies and surveys that are based on these data. The National Ocean Service under NOAA, they map harbor mouths for safety of navigation type things. Their only mission is safety of navigation, so they don't stray very far from harbor entrances. And we've been out there a number of times for both fisheries and active fault things, so we have our own targets. And so we get sort of a hodgepodge of postage stamps, but still the total is only 5% of the territorial sea. So at that rate, it'll take about 50 to 60 years, we think, to fill it in.
If you could follow up. And maybe you don't know this number off the top of your head, but if you were going to map just directly in front of urban areas along the Oregon coast for tsunamis, what kind of dollar figure are you talking about just to hit the target, areas?
That's a good question. I don't actually know the number. I would guess that would amount to probably maybe 20% of the total.
Mm-hmm.
Would probably be cost-wise, though I don't know the number.
Okay.
So in our in the Territorial Sea Plan, we've examined a number of different models in terms of how to get this done, and Oregon is has a unique set of circumstances. California is also doing the same sort of thing, but California doesn't really have a tsunami hazard. Well, they do, but a much smaller one. They don't have as much commercial fishing, and they have a really sort of a different mindset. If you've represented Boone, you've been to the meetings, and so most of their work is their plan is to use commercial contractors to just do the job and be done with it. And what we proposed to do essentially the same thing, but use a bit of a different model. And our model includes using idled fishing vessels to get the work done, because Oregon's fishing industry has been hit hard by closures and so forth, and to set up a mini institute to train students to do the job. We have the expertise at OSU already to do this, and it's just a matter of manpower. It's fairly simple work when it really to do. So our model would include the fishing boats and faculty RAs and student training to do the work. And part of the aim is to fit Oregon's circumstances, but part of the aim is also to have an educational component to the whole thing and train people in a new, relatively new field.
And just 1 second. Yeah. Senator Jensen?
I think this is a great model, and I applaud it, particularly because many of the people I represent are these underemployed fishermen. Representative Boone and I were in a lengthy meeting last night talking about a variety of issues that included insurance. And at the point that you go to private owner-operators, what insurance are you relying on when you load up scientists and students onto a privately owned vessel and head out into the water?
Well, this vessel is the one that we mapped those banks in Southern California with in just those circumstances. It's a privately owned vessel. OSU people, as long as they're employed by OSU, are covered by OSU insurance. And the vessel has its own insurance. They have their own liability. But OSU people would be covered by that.
I may rethink my enthusiasm for this as I notice on the back of the vessel it says Seattle, Washington. The Washington jumped right out at me. I feel a chill blowing through.
I knew I was going to catch some flack for that. I use this vessel because it's one that we actually mobilized and did seafloor mapping with, but I presume that we'd be using Oregon vessels.
Right answer.
Yeah. Senator Johnson, I could say that maybe this will help you feel better, as the Tri-State Compact may alleviate some of that fear of competition. They've all three governors of Washington State, Oregon, and California have agreed to work together cooperatively on ocean issues.
Yeah, that's correct. Sorry about the Washington boat. But I just wanted to show an example of one that was actually put to work for this purpose, and we mobilized this boat in Southern California, and in about 2 days you can turn it from essentially a fishing vessel into a research vessel. And this is the upper picture. There is a group of students attaching the sonar pole up there, and then this is the, quote, lab space, which was really a Sears tool shed strapped to the deck, and the computer set up here inside. And so here's the sonar apparatus. It's quite simple. The device is bolted onto a steel pole. It's just mounted into a pivot on the side of the boat. So almost any vessel that can sleep about six and operate overnight can do this type of work. And so here's just the results that were obtained from that vessel in only 2 weeks' time. And this is about three quarters of the shallow submarine banks in the borderlands of Southern California. So it actually goes pretty fast.
So if you did the rest of the project in Oregon, how long would it take if you were funded to get the 95% to the capacity that you would need to do an effective tsunami model?
It's highly weather dependent, so it's hard to put a fixed number on that. We think that if it were funded all at once and we were able to mobilize five or six boats to work simultaneously, that we could do it in two summers.
Okay.
But our field season is short, and this collecting this type of data is pretty weather dependent. If the weather's rough, the data goes downhill quickly, so you have to have fairly nice weather. So in a good year or a good two summers, we could do it.
Okay.
Some of the other data that you get, aside from just bathymetry, which is this, you can also get water column data showing where the fish actually live. And this is an image from that same data set as the previous slide, but processed to pull out the fish data from the water column. So this is something that's not really a collection of or analysis of, isn't really in this proposal, but this is something we expect that NOAA would probably want to put additional funds into piggyback this type of work, so you could actually carry this forward into.
I was going to ask you about that too. If you partner with other groups, if you can get their, they expect to get a piece of data they can use too. You can get three hits with one.
Yeah. And as in the marine realm, ship time is everything. And once people hear that a project is going and boats are going out, people line up around the block to piggyback experiments and things on the vessel. So I can't even begin to go into the things that we've talked to people about for that. But definitely water column sonar would be one of them. Drop cameras or tow cameras for biological observations will be another. And there'll be quite a bit of that.
Senator Johnson?
Give those of us that don't deal with these images a sense of scale. What are we looking at?
This I'm not sure the exact scale, but I'm guessing this is about a half a mile long and about a couple of hundred yards wide. And these are schools of fish here, not individual fish, but large schools of fish over a reef area in Southern California. So this is not even at full resolution. Some of the better sonars built since this one was used can image down to individual fish on the order of a foot or so in size. So the technology is really exploded in the last couple of years. This was impossible about 5 years ago. And now fisheries biologists are seriously talking about using sonars to image where the fish really are. And so that's a new development.
How long until this slips into the commercial fishing market?
Oh, well, they've had this for quite a long time. What's different about this, though, is when you look on a commercial vessel and see a fish finder, you see sonar images of the fish, and they use those all the time. But what this does is it maps the fish in a wide swath and in three dimensions all at once, which is not common on fishing vessels these days. If Terry's still here, you can comment on that.
What you're seeing there.
Terry, why don't you come forward? Why don't you come forward so we can get you on the record? And ID yourself.
We've been playing with different versions of that. My name's Terry Thompson, commercial fish from the Oregon Coast and also County Commissioner. We've had versions of this for years and done it even down to situation, but he's absolutely right. The last few years, this three-dimensional program has really stepped out. As far as increasing the efficiency of the industry, all we need to know is where the fish are at, and we'll catch them. So that technology has actually been around for 10 or 15 years, but it sure makes for pretty pictures this way.
Shooting fish in a barrel?
Well, only for
on
certain,
a large scale.
Understand, though, it's only for certain species. This is probably some sort of I don't know the depth he's got there in the water, but this is some sort of either black rockfish or something like that, or brown rockfish. You still can't see most of the sole species and stuff on the bottom very well, so it's that part of the fishing industry hasn't changed. It's only for the rock cod that it made it a lot easier.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
So even though these tools have been around for a while, they haven't really been applied systematically to really understand fish habitat and in terms of what scientists think of habitat as opposed to where fishermen go to catch fish is a little bit different thing. And habitat is really... The understanding of habitat is at a very, very low level right now. We know that rockfish like rocks, flat fish like sandy areas, and that's about it, really. And so the data, what would happen to the data? Once it's processed and interpreted, we have a number of ways to disseminate the data, and most of those... really add no cost to the project at all. One of them, if this link works, we'll see if it actually works. One of them already exists. This is a federally NOAA-funded data portal called IUS or PACUS, and this is the Ocean Observing System that's quite well funded through NOAA. And so we can take advantage of the IUS system, which is designed to connect data sets and sensors and various things into a quote, ocean observing system. And IUS doesn't have any plans to map the seafloor. They're interested in the water itself, what the water is doing. They really don't seem to have an interest in the seafloor. But through the IUS program, we've gotten funding to develop this data portal. So it allows you, I didn't have time to hook up the wireless link, but it allows you to search the data graphically through a GIS interface, to search through other kinds of data tools and connect to databases or other sensors directly. So this is something that this project can piggyback on and essentially load the data in here and at no cost at all.
So you could actually get data that would give you the capacity to map the tsunami inundation zone, how the water might behave once it comes on shore, and also have fish habitat data and places along the coast where there might not be ocean wave energy location stuff.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the databases themselves, the bathymetry data and the seafloor morphology and the seafloor lithology, you know, the geology, and the fish data, which mostly comes from scientific observations and NOAA trawl surveys and some fishermen data, those data are already built into this, and you can do cross-link searches, say rubber band box and area of the seafloor, that'll tell you what species live there, what the seafloor is made of, and things like that. If you're interested, I can give you a demo of that. But so that capability exists now, and what we would be doing is adding the new bathymetry data, and on top of that, it's quite simple to add decision tools. So you can put the tsunami inundation on there, and query it for, you know, what are the effects of an inundation line that's here versus here. You can query it for what would be the effects of a marine protected area if you put it here versus there, and that sort of thing. And so OPAC is pursuing getting those decision tools built once the data exists. And so we also have a couple of other outlets that already exist, the Oregon Ocean Atlas and the OSU Oregon Explorer, which is through the library that has links to legal and historical documentation of coastal various, well, actually it's for the whole state of Oregon. And then in the project is included a collaboration with Dogami to put out digital and paper maps through the state as well. So here's just a quick summary of what's included in the project. We would acquire about 900 square miles, just miles, not acres, of bathymetric data in the territorial sea, and this would be full coverage out to the 3-mile limit and up to the surf zone. We would use Oregon fishing vessels where possible. The gear would be leased, but we would purchase one system that would be retained by the state, and that system would be available for nice good weather windows during the year, wherever they happen to happen. And the model, as I mentioned, would be based on a mini institute that would include outreach, student training, and so forth. We would integrate the offshore data with existing deeper water data, existing shallow water data, NASA onshore topography and LIDAR data that exists, and proposed estuarine data from Dogami. We would acquire about 1,500 bottom samples to ground truth the bathymetric data, and not the bathymetric data, but the interpretations of seafloor geology. Would include complete processing, interpretation of the data, integration of the data with that web server that I just showed you, and paper map production with Dogami. Now, Dogami is also proposing, as I'm sure you know, a tsunami acceleration package. And so Vicky McConnell and Ian Maiden and our group have talked extensively about how to do that. And Dogami would take over the tsunami project essentially at the shoreline, and also augment the bathymetry data with surveys of all the estuaries in Oregon and LIDAR data. So there's no overlap between our projects, and we're working pretty closely together on it, as well as working closely on the tsunami modeling that will follow the data collection. So our estimate for the project is $5.82 million in today's dollars. We think we can do it in 2 years, but it's highly weather dependent. And we would take about a year for processing, although processing would be ongoing as the data collection goes forward. The Dogami package, I put this up here just to show you what their plans are. They're going to collect bathymetric data in the estuaries where no data exists presently. And they're also going to collect coastal LIDAR data to give you a very detailed picture of the topography. The reason that they're so interested in that is not only coastal erosion, which they've been interested in for years, but also the detailed topography is important for modeling the tsunami as it runs up onto land. It's not just the marine data that's important. They would carry on from there and continue doing the subduction zone tsunami source modeling, like the Cannon Beach project I showed you earlier on. And that would include paleo-tsunami deposits, radiometric dating, and so forth, to put together a complete picture of tsunami inundation in the past and expected from future Cascadia earthquakes. So I think that's all I have for now, and I'd be happy to
thank you.
Get more questions.
Senator Johnson?
Interesting. Are these two funding requests, the 5 point whatever and the 6 million, built into any budgets that are making their way through the system in this biennium?
They are. The budget for this is not presently, but Representative Boone is considering proposal of such a bill.
I am. I am proposing not the Dogami piece, but the other piece, and I have a bill in that will cover that.
With the
via
funds
Dogami.
Coming from where?
Well, that's to be determined at this point.
And Dogami, I'm not sure what the root of that is, but Dogami is a two. I'm sorry, this is wrong. This is that's my mistake. It was about $2.4 million for the Dogami package.
The Dogami, yeah.
And this is complementary data collection, not duplicative.
Right. Essentially, we would stop at the surf line, and they would take over and do the estuaries and land from there.
And it's a package that goes together, so you could build a model that could show you how the wave would behave.
Yeah, that's right. To get a good model, particularly since you're interested in urban areas, to get a complete model of what's really going to happen, you need the marine data and the land data, and even beyond that, you need the building data. The built environment is part of the tsunami model. As the tsunami comes ashore, it's running through buildings and trees and everything else. And to accurately model that, you need complete land data. And the LIDAR data actually produces 3D. It images the buildings as well as the land.
Madam Chair, this is an issue, all this GIS, that keeps coming up over and over and over again. We have pockets of it scattered throughout state government. DAS, Department of Administrative Services, is looking at a big package. Department of Revenue already does one. The counties gather this information in a sometimes really good way, sometimes haphazard. And I'm not just referring to coastal counties gathering other data. My concern is that as we collect this data, pay for the collection of the data, that we figure out some way to use it in some coherent way so that we don't have this, these pockets of data that have no relationship to each other. And I know that there are very specific purposes that can be teased out from these kinds of data sets. You've already made that clear in your presentation. But my concern is the apparent, at least in my opinion, the apparent failure to coordinate GIS activities that are paid for with state funds.
No, that's a great point. And it's partly just due to the way GIS and computing systems have evolved. Everyone has the computer on their desktop, and they want to load in all the data and do their little job, and then they don't want to go any further than that and coordinate, and it's actually fairly difficult to do that. The plus side is the technology is evolving to the point now where the Internet is fast enough that computers, people on their desktops, can actually broadcast their data to other computers. So you don't have to go around and physically collect it from people or call them on the phone and say, can I have all your data so I can do my project? You can actually broadcast it with a web link. And so a person in Salem somewhere who might not have thought they needed marine data can actually just click on that IUS portal web link and get our data without doing much of anything. So the old system is breaking down, and it's becoming more of an interconnected system where computers have the sort of distributed nature of computing is being taken advantage of instead of being a speed bump like you suggest.
To follow up, Madam Chair. Yeah. Well, and my point is I want to have the collection of this data paid for with public money have the greatest applicability possible without hampering your mission. I mean, clearly you have a unique mission in doing certain analysis of certain data sets. Conversely, you've got a whole bunch of information. And I'm trying to envision a day when somebody who is standing at the Land Development Services counter in Sherman County can press up the state's GIS and get data about Tillamook County.
Mm-hmm.
Reliable, accurate data. Property lines, center lines of roads, all of this sort of stuff. Some of your stuff would be applicable. Some of it clearly has only a scientific application. But to the degree that public funds are being paid to gather this, how you can contribute to a statewide base just gets added value for the money.
Mm-hmm. No, that day is actually almost here. It's essentially here for anybody who wants to do it. You can, a county guy in anywhere in the state or anywhere in the country or the world, for that matter, can go to not everybody's web database, but to some web databases that are set up properly and load the data for other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that will become commonplace. It's unusual right now, but in the next 5 years, that will become, just like Google Earth is normal and didn't exist last year, it'll become commonplace in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
Jerry? We have been very successful at working with Chris and the county, and because of the attempt to be involved in wave action generators. Chris has gave us the information, ODF&W has gave the information, and we've compiled it into a complete map of our county. Then we took the nearshore information that we already had in our county data system, and then we took the Central Lincoln TUD former sites so that we could do the connection. But let me warn you, one thing you run into when you get to a certain level is Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
You run right flat into Homeland Security, mm-hmm. and that's it's a kind of a sticky wicket of where do you draw the line between information that goes out to the public good and where do you draw the line of what's Homeland Security?
And respectfully, yeah. Mr. Commissioner, you use the word Homeland Security. I would also add TERF. Who can charge for the data? Who can manipulate the data? What's deemed proprietary in one place versus another place? What are all the hindrances offered by liability? But the more I hear about this session, the more I am convinced that TERF is being dressed up in a lot of other nomenclature.
Well, let me say this about the OSU data. We didn't run into a turf situation. We ran into literally Homeland Security situation. We felt that when we asked for information, everyone was more than willing to give us the information so that we could compile the information to do what we felt was good site locations. But I haven't run directly into anybody that's done it in our area that I've had contact. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but the turf is not there.
If the Department of Administrative Services rang up Lincoln County and asked for your data, would you readily provide it to the state?
We would be more than happy to do that up to the point of the Central Lincoln PUD power substation sites and proposed sites into the future. They would have to get that permission from Central Lincoln PUD.
Cool.
We're fortunate in one small way is that if we were trying to do bathymetry in Washington, we would have a problem because the Navy has tried to classify the bathymetry data in Washington because they like to play Hunt for Red October with the submarines up there. Fortunately, they don't seem to care about Oregon, so we don't have any Navy problems in Oregon. And in terms of from what Terry said, at Homeland Security, there's actually another problem. One of our biggest hindrances to getting data out and making it widely disseminated is just hackers. I mean, all of the security things that we have to have on our databases to keep them from being hacked make it hard for people that we want to get in to get in. And that's actually our biggest problem. And
you're talking about some graduate student with a fast computer and a fertile mind.
Somebody in Istanbul or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
We had a new server last year that was hacked within. We were still reading the manual. I mean, it was plugged into the internet for no more than 5 minutes and it got hacked. So that's actually our biggest real problem.
Well, I want to thank you for this, Dr. Goldfinger. In consideration for time, our next presenter has to leave at 4:30, so I want to make sure he gets in. Thank you very much. If anybody has any further questions.
Madam Chair, just
sure,
real quickly, the question may be to you. I'm just trying to clarify these numbers. I got a little lost. I heard 5.6 and 6 million and 2.5, and what is your bill asking for?
I think we're between 5 and 6 or something like whatever the number was that we
and
had.
And then 2.5 for Dogami?
Yeah. I didn't have that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That was an error on my last slide. The Dogami package was about... It's over 2. I can't remember exactly what the number was.
2 plus.
Right. I'm just trying to track it. Thanks.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
We may call you again sometime. And I want to thank you for such an upbeat, positive presentation. You guys have no idea how depressing his last one was. He had visuals, too, which were really scary. So we'll call Ted Brecken up, who will talk about Wave Energy Report.
I'm going to turn to Bobby a little bit.
Yes. And while he's setting up, if anybody has any comments or... Thank you, Chris. It's good. It was a nice update, too. It sounds like things are getting closer to...
I have to give a lot of credit to Diana. They really pedal to the metal on this.
Oh, they have. And they have done so much on earthquake prep and all that. And
Their effort is really probably the best in the world.
That's good news. We can be proud of them.
I just see too much opportunity for mischief.
She's just on the house talking to her.
You're in the process of doing good mowing in here.
Okay.
My chairs weren't going in because it wasn't at census.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
So is he ready?
Getting close. Yeah. Well, and you know, while we're waiting for Is it Dr. Brecken?
That's correct.
Dr. Brecken to set up. I just want to comment on this whole project that we've been hearing about today and how important it is. And it's I'm just really happy to hear that Dogami's moved forward so rapidly. And this is a really, really important area for the local entities to plan for, you know, a tsunami and at the same time help our fisheries get some information that they might need. You know, it's kind of a twofer hit. And the fact that they're planning to use our out-of-work or slowed-down fisheries vessels to gather the data, that's really good news, too, because that puts these people to work, and they want to work. And that's a third value in it. Senator George, do you have any reports from what's happening in Hong Kong regarding to this issue? I'm just kidding, putting you on the spot.
Okay, I'm ready, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Just for the record, if you'd identify yourself.
Sure, I'm Dr. Ted Brecken from the Energy Systems Group at Oregon State University.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and to the rest of the panel as well. Good afternoon. So today I'm talking about the WayPower program at Oregon State University. There's myself, Dr. Ted Brecken, and also Dr. Annette Van Juan. We both together are the Energy Systems Group, and a lot of this, the majority of this was built on the work from Dr. Alan Wallace, who passed away last year.
I'm sorry to hear that, too.
Yes, it was in part, I'm new at Oregon State this year, and in part I was hired to replace the position that his passing vacated, but it left a tremendous hole in the knowledge, the areas that he specialized in. It was quite a loss, and it was a big loss, of course, to Dr. Van Juan as well, because they were very, very close. He was very well known and well liked within the energy community.
And I've heard her presentation, and she's going to be giving it again. She's continuing to give her presentation to groups up and down the coast.
Uh-huh.
We'll be in Astoria. You'll probably be with her, I think.
I believe so, yes.
Later in the year. So.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay, proceed.
And in addition to ourselves, of course, we're very fortunate to have an excellent group of graduate students. So we have several senior design teams involved with us as well. And we also work closely. We have our port liaison project team with the local fishermen and crabbers and our Newport Wave Energy team, which, of course, Terry Thompson is a member of as well. I'm sorry. Hold on a second. I got all this up.
It's on its own.
Go back. What are you doing? Okay, I'm sorry. So we have three main thrust areas at Oregon State University. The first of which is the technical part of it, which is actually researching and developing the wave energy generation technology. So it's actually developing the generators, the buoys themselves. In addition to that, we have two administrative thrusts, and that's developing an action plan for National Wave Energy Research and Demonstration Center. So that we want the National Wave Energy Center to be here in Oregon, so that if a company on the East Coast develops a wave energy technology, they come to Oregon and go off the coast here to test that technology. Europe has at least two similar sites. it would be sort of an NREL West, you can kind of think of it. And also working with the Department of Energy and other variety of other stakeholders to try and get companies to come to Oregon and our excellent, outstanding wave energy potentials that we have here and put in actual commercial wave parks. And we have interest from at least several companies, the foremost being Ocean Power Technology in New Jersey. The NREL West that I discussed, kind of our National Wave Energy Demonstration Center, that has been authorized but not yet appropriated, and when it comes around, we think it will be very competitive to try and get it. In addition, there's been some noise in California that they, of course, would be interested in it, and Washington as well. But we think at Oregon State University, we think we're very well poised for this particular center because of the resources that we have on OSU. We have our engineering facilities. We have the OH Hinsdale Wave Research Lab, and we have the Hatfield Marine Science Center, and some other factors that I'll talk about in a little bit that make Oregon an excellent fit for that. So why should we be concerned about ocean wave energy in Oregon? First of all, when you talk about wave energy, there's actually several different types of ocean energy. When you're talking about extracting energy from the ocean, you can do it with tidal, you can do it with temperature gradients, you can do it with salinity, you can do it if you just consider water energy in general. Of course, you have hydro. But we're talking about what we're interested in is wave energy. We're actually using the motion of the waves to generate electrical energy. This technology is still very much in its infancy. There's over 1,000 patents, but less than 2 megawatts installed, so tremendous number of ideas and people toying around with different things, but not yet at all coalesced into an established industry. We think that we're somewhere like where wind energy was maybe 15 or 20 years ago. So we consider. Water is about 832 times as dense as air. So a moving volume of water has a tremendous amount of energy, and it is tremendously high energy density. There was a European group that estimated that somewhere around 0.2% of the ocean's energy could provide power for the entire world. So a tremendous amount of energy in the ocean. And compared to other renewables, it has several advantages, one of which being the higher energy density that I just mentioned, also have higher availability, because the waves tend to be more consistent. They're there more often than, say, wind energy, for example, which can come and go in a matter of minutes. And excellent predictability, which is actually a huge, huge advantage, technically speaking, for wave energy, because if you think of one of the things that limits, I don't mean to pick on wind energy, actually I've done a lot of work with wind energy, it's a great technology, but one of the limitations that it faces is that you don't know whether the wind's going to be there or not 1 minute to the next. So it's impractical at this point, the technology that we have today, that you could have a grid made up of 100% wind energy. The utility just doesn't know whether it's going to be there 1 minute or not. So it limits the penetration in the grid that you can make up of wind energy. But one significant advantage of wave energy is that you can actually see the waves coming maybe 10 hours off. That, I mean, wind, you're lucky if you know what's going to happen a minute or two in the future. But to know what's going to happen in 10 hours is a tremendous advantage for wave energy, a hugely positive aspect of it. The wave energy extraction technologies can kind of be boiled down into four main groups. There's the point absorber design. You see Ocean Power Technologies Power Buoy there, the New Jersey company. So that one, just when the wave comes, it just heaves up and down. It moves up and down in what we call the heave direction. They also have an oscillating water column. There's one of these installed in England called the Limpet. It's a 500 kilowatt. This type of technology, if you can imagine, if you could flip a bowl upside down and put it in the water and poke a hole in the top, and when the wave comes in, it compresses the air in there, and the air rushes out through a small hole, and you put an air turbine there, a compressed air turbine, to capture that energy. There's also an attenuator that's Ocean Power Delivery in Scotland. That's their 750 kVA Palamas device, which they call the wave snake, which lays across the waves, and the wave comes in, and the whole thing goes like this. It's kind of like a link of sausages, you can almost think of it. And then where it bends at those articulation points, they drive hydraulics, which drive a rotary generator. They're probably the world leader in terms of wave energy and actually having a lot of experience in the water with a very high power device. And then we have overtopping devices, which the wave comes over, fills a basin, and as the water drains out of the basin, you generate electricity with a low head water turbine. The Danish are interested in that technology and have some, actually they have a 4 megawatt device and are looking at going up as high as 20 megawatts. I apologize, this slide is slow to load. So this is just kind of an artist's conception of what we're talking about then, where we have we have a point absorber design, and on the spar, what we call the spar, so the spar, the center column is anchored. You can see it's anchored to the ocean floor. And it would be positively buoyant. So it's held in tension by its desire to float to the surface. And that has magnets on it. And then on the outside, we have this float, which is the part that heaves up and down in the wave. And you can see as the float heaves up and down, there are coils that slice through the magnetic field produced by the magnets on the spar. So when every time you have a conductor or a coil of wire moving through a magnetic field, you have a voltage and current induced on that. That's how we would generate the electricity. At OSU, we have several excellent resources specific to us. We have our Motor Systems Resource Facility, which is, we have a full 3/4 megawatt, 750 kilowatt direct connection to the grid. We can fully regenerate at 750 kVA. It's the largest motor systems research lab, university-based motor systems research lab in the U.S., we also have, of course, the OH Hinsdale Wave Research Lab, which is a world-class wave flume and tsunami basin. We've actually used their facility before to test some of buoy ideas that we've had. At OSU, there are a variety of...
Senator Johnson.
I'm sorry.
Excuse
yes.
me, just a second.
My question is going to reveal how little I know about science and fish. At what point do you take a preliminary look at the effect of the magnetic field on fish?
Yes, actually, we're discussing that right now. We have several environmental action plans. I've had other departments in the university kind of help us out with that. We know that I have a slide that addresses that a little bit later, but we know that ocean life is attracted to electromagnetic fields. So it is a concern. We don't know if it would be a negative effect at this point, and there are mitigating things that we can do to eliminate or attenuate the electromagnetic fields that are generated by these devices. But it's a concern that I should add that the same thing is true of ships, any underwater cabling, which are very common, crisscrossing all over the place. They have these same types of issues. So some of the same things that you see with them, we would say with wave energy as well. There were several studies done. There was an EPRI study, which I have a slide on in a second, but there are several studies that have been done that verify that we have, Oregon has actually outstanding wave energy potentials. We are an outstanding wave energy climate. You see here, months plotted along the x-axis there, starting from January going to December, and then we see plotted against wave power, a kilowatt per meter crest length. So what this means is, if you think of the wave coming toward you, okay, if you're standing on the shore and you think of the wave coming toward you and the crest length goes along parallel to the shore. If you look at 1 meter of that crest length, okay, so 3 feet across, in the winter, you get about 50 kilowatts per meter. 50 kilowatts will run about somewhere 35 homes, maybe. So you have the power to run about 35 homes in 1 meter of crest length in the winter. In the summer, that goes down to about 10, averages about 30. So, again, just stressing it's a tremendous amount of power in a wave. Another interesting aspect of wave energy is it's matched to the load. You see, west of the Cascades, we have consumption about 3.5 gigawatts. But the generation, the column right to the side, see generation is 2.5. So where most of the people live is not where the generation is. But if you look east of the Cascades, there's not so many people living there, 1.6 gigawatts of consumption, but that's where all the production is. And that's the typical, a lot of areas where a lot of your production is not where the people live. But with wave energy, that's a benefit because, of course, most of the people tend to live along the coast, and that's where wave energy is. This EPRI study, I think my next slide is on that, found that there were 7 sites within Oregon. EPRI is the Electrical Power Research Institute. That's a group that's funded by all the utilities. They pump money into it, and then it used to fund universities more so back in the day, but it does its own independent research. And found that Oregon had 7 sites that were with the potential to expand to about 100 megawatts of generation. Here's the sites that were identified in the EPRI study. Of course, Newport was an excellent site, and we're working very closely with the Newport people. And then the Gardner-Reedsport area is a site in particular that Ocean Power Technology, the New Jersey company with their power buoy, sometime within the next 3 to 5 years are looking at dropping about 20 megawatts and possibly expanding up to 40 or 50 off the Reedsport area. On the technical front, what we're really interested in at OSU, or what makes us somewhat unique, is applying what we call a direct drive technology. And that's where if you think that you have, like Ocean Power Technologies, hydraulically driven buoy, for example, you have this thing heaving up and down, and it moves a piston which drives hydraulics. So you have something, you have something moving on the outside where all the seawater is, and it's a tremendously corrosive, difficult environment for mechanical systems to operate. And at some point that penetrates down into the machine and drives hydraulics. So you have a working seal there somewhere. You have a seal that has to keep out all the seawater from the inside of the machine, and that has to accommodate some kind of a sliding surface at some point. And that's a huge mechanical weakness. And one of the things at OSU that we're looking at is eliminating that using magnetic fields to couple outside motion to inside motion. So the magnetic field couples between some watertight barrier and you don't have any kind of a sliding seal. A couple of the technologies that we're looking at, on the left is our permanent magnet linear generator that actually operates exactly like that artist conception slide that I had where you have magnets moving through a coil. A permanent magnet rack and pinion type drive, where we have permanent magnets on pinions and then permanent magnets on a rack. And as the rack moves, it turns the pinions with no direct contact between them, just connected via a magnetic field. And on the right is a similar design that we call contactless force transmission, whereas the float heaves up and down. As this heaves up and down, it actually moves a piston. And here, there's a magnetic coupling between them, and as the piston heaves up and down, it spins a shaft, and that shaft is connected to a rotary generator. We have a very multidisciplinary team of graduate students working, of course, on the technical end, on the electrical engineering side of things. We also have several mechanical engineering students involved with help in construction of these devices. And we also have an ocean engineering student with us who's been a huge help, who's helping us with computational fluid dynamics problems. Modeling how a buoy behaves in the water is a very difficult problem. And at present, there are not a lot of adequate, even at the cutting edge, there are not a lot of adequate programs that can handle this problem. It's extremely complex. So we're having an ocean engineering student and actually a computer science student helping us with trying to navigate this problem, and very much at the cutting edge. We're talking with a researcher at the University of Edinburgh, which is one of the main wave energy universities, one of the leading wave energy universities in the world, and working closely with one of their researchers and trying to solve these problems. The environmental protocol that we have here, you can see that there's a variety of things that we're considering very, very carefully, both for ourselves and also working very closely with the Newport team, and trying to tap into knowledge that the fishermen and the people that are out there in the water have. There are several different things we need to consider. There's the effect on, how is the electromagnetic radiation generated by the buoy? How's that going to affect wildlife? There's also things like mooring. You're going to moor this thing, and so you have to put something at the bottom of the ocean. How's that going to affect the habitat? You have to lay it cables, right? And that technology is well known. It's done all the time, but you have to be very careful about where you dig those cables, where you dig the trench, and where you put them. Yes?
Okay, one question.
I've been watching this from our thing this morning again today, and I go back to one issue, and that is the mooring.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen what the ocean does to these big oil rigs with 3-inch cables. Eventually, they tear loose, and I can foresee a group of these. We're talking 200 of them in 1.5 square miles. If it ever started breaking loose, I can see just about like you have with the commercial fishermen's crab pots. Pretty soon, you've got all this massive wire and stuff together.
Mm-hmm. There are several. You're right. And it is obviously it needs to be something that's designed for in the same way that the oil industry does. This ocean engineering student that we have actually has worked for the oil industry, so he's been very, very helpful in bringing some of that knowledge in. And there are several different mooring. There are tension moorings where it is held in tension and it absorbs a lot of the blow of the wave. And there are slack mooring schemes where the mooring is not held in tension and does not absorb the immediate hit of the wave. There are a couple different, some of those are more affected than others, but certainly it is something that needs to be designed for.
I think, Madam Chair, that's just going to be one of the bigger challenges when they actually start doing it. They're going to figure out the ocean is extremely powerful during our big storms that we have.
Yeah,
that model, the pilot project will be good for getting some of that information on a smaller scale.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yep. We're collaborating with the whole group. It's very, very multidisciplinary. We're involved with all sorts of people. BPA on the right here. We actually hoped we were supposed to hear on Friday, and then it was supposed to be mid this week, and we still haven't heard. But we have a very large proposal with them that we're very anxious to hear about. And if that's funded, that will go a long way toward funding our efforts to establish a test berth, a 10 kilowatt test berth, where we can test these devices actually in the ocean. And of course, a variety of all other agencies involved with us as well. So the bottom line is that Oregon has an outstanding, is very uniquely poised to lead the nation, even be a world leader in wave energy when you consider all of the advantages and the resources that we have. Another one that actually I missed on a slide earlier, but I wanted to mention, that very, very unique to wave energy, and one of the big problems with wind energy, is that wind energy tends to blow where people aren't. So you can identify, like North Dakota. I'm from North Dakota. North Dakota's windy as heck.
You can tell by the accent.
Really? I've had people, I can't believe people can pick it up. But anyway, I've had more people tell me that since I've been in Oregon than anywhere else. But the tremendous wind energy resources in North Dakota. So you could fill the whole place up with wind turbines and produce enough power to power the entire U.S. But you got to ship it all out of there. You got to build all these transmission lines to get out. So building transmission lines to accommodate renewable energy is one of the big costs that are built into it. With Oregon, we have a lot of the infrastructure that serviced paper industries and other logging industries along the coast that aren't there anymore, but all the transmission infrastructure still is. So the utilities have told us that we have somewhere around 2 gigawatts or so that we could put in on the coast with no upgrading of the infrastructure at all, which is a tremendous, tremendous advantage that we were very lucky to have. So in summary, Oregon really is a sweet spot for wave energy, all things considered. We also have Dr. Von Juan wanted me to talk about this Oregon Innovation Council proposal that was successful. It's $5.23 million for 2 years to advance ocean wave energy. OSU gets about $500,000 of that, and a lot of the other money goes to establish a wave energy trust, also establishing various market devices to try and offset some of the cost. And also some money going toward the siting of this wave energy demonstration facility.
Just a thought that I have about this is the details are beginning to emerge. The Wave Energy Trust at $300,000 a year, which is basically, it appears, administrative, I'm trying to figure out why the Energy Trust of Oregon can't participate in some of this stuff. They're supposed to be identifying alternative power sources, and they have a fee mechanism that collects money and pours through that operation. And I just don't know whether or not, in the context of Oregon Inc., anybody has discussed whether or not the Energy Trust could be participatory in doing this.
That's an excellent idea and suggestion.
Well noted.
Cool.
So, is there any other questions?
Anybody have any questions for Dr. Brecken?
Actually, it would be very helpful if you didn't object to have a copy of your PowerPoint.
Absolutely. Actually, it is freely available on our website. I'll certainly give you that address.
Cool.
Thank you. Senator George.
I hope you didn't cover this. I had to step out real quickly. But when you were talking about having power produced on the Oregon coast, if there's a tsunami, would that provide power for the Oregon coast?
Would the wave energy generation devices?
Yeah, I mean, right now.
Would they work during a tsunami?
Right. I mean, like no. would it would not?
No.
I mean,
it depends on the magnitude.
I mean, would you be able to keep the would we lose that infrastructure, or is that something that could actually help in during recovery times of having a source on the coast?
It depends very much on the technology. It depends very much on how the technology is designed to survive an event like that. It's actually a big challenge for wave energy. With wind energy, for example, if you have strong winds, they just pitch the blades out of the wind. So it's like a pole. You know, it doesn't totally invisible to the wind, more or less. With wave energy, you're stuck in the wave. You've got to deal with it. And different technologies deal with it in different ways. Some of the technologies may be able to would survive the first the tsunami hit and then would be able to immediately generate on the next wave. Other technologies may survive it, but they may be knocked out of commission for a short time until maybe an operator can go out there and can reinitialize the device. It just depends very much on the type of technology and how it's designed to survive the event. What we're thinking of with our buoys, one of our ideas is that we may just winch them under. So in the case of, there's a couple different ideas. One is that if you have any warning at all, is that you can winch them under. And they may be able to do this very quickly, actually. They may be even able to sense that the force is much too strong and pull under. And then be released back up at some time later. Another idea that we have is just to simply let the floats come off. You know, you have the spar and a float on the outside, and we just may tether them together, but they're not connected in any other way. And then the strong wave comes up, and it just pops the float off. And then of course, someone has to go out and reassemble the device, but at least you haven't lost a million-dollar device.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Wow. Any more questions? Very good information, and I took some notes here, too. Thank you very much, and I hope we might call on you at some point in the future if we have more questions.
My pleasure.
And welcome aboard, and with Professor Von Schuwen, she is a ball of fire, I have to say.
Yeah, I enjoy working with
her. I'm glad that you're on board. And where in North Dakota are you from? Which part?
Devil's Lake, North Dakota. She's in
east
the
west.
It's in the east. It's about.
That's the accent.
We're fairly close. can you tell an east and a west North Dakota accent? Are you from North Dakota?
No, I have a farm there. A little farm. Senator Johnson has to leave. Thank you very much for your good questions. Terry Thompson.
Could I add a little bit to this? Because Newport's played an important role with OSU since its development. Annette Von Schuwen has been fabulous to work with, and we're very interested in development of a research center offshore to understand more about these types of buoys. We're proceeding with fishermen's groups to work collaboratively with OSU with no funds. These guys are doing their own. In fact, they're coming over Saturday to meet and go through the laboratory. We've established that through the county. All I can say is OSU, I think, may have one of the answers in this device that they're working with, where it's a direct drive system. And there are other systems out there that are working, but I think it's well worth the state putting money into it. And I highly encourage this committee. And I'd like to come back over sometime and talk to you a little bit about how the county perceives our role in the development of wave action generators, because it's quite an interesting process. We filed for the entire 3 miles off of Oregon coast.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, it's great to have you in. And I was wondering, when we were talking about this, about having fields of wave energy, how does that interact with the fishermen out there? Obviously there has to be coordination, but is there ways to create big, large fields of wave energy that won't interfere with commercial fisheries, or what's sort of that status?
Well, I'll give a brief explanation of what our stand is. Right now, we do about $100 million worth of fisheries out of Newport. And we don't believe that we should lose the existing renewable food resource for the development of renewable power. And we believe by bringing a fishermen's group together who understands that, this fine, they call it, organization, we can work collaboratively with Wave Power to site those in an area where they have minimal amount of impact on the food-producing resources that are so important to our area.
That's good news, because that's been a question among when we had a little presentation in Coastal Caucus meeting this morning.
One of the problems is under the FERC process, which has the authority, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they have super siting, and there isn't really a place for public input until you get way down in the process, and that's why we took it on ourselves to make that filing. And because there is a priority for municipalities that goes back years and years, that's the basis for our filing. And like I say, I'm glad to bring the lawyers over and sit down and talk to you about why we did what we're doing and why we're serious and we plan on staying involved. But we also want to push forward as much as possible to support OSU and other wave energy sites. And the important part is that we get this fine group, this fishermen's group, up so we can work in a collaborative nature.
We will invite you. Thank you for the offer. Thank you very much, Dr. Brecken. I am so happy to hear all that good
Thank
news.
You. Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, and the rest of the board.
Is there any further business before the committee? If not, we stand adjourned.